Hello. Welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thank you for tuning in. Today we will continue our reading of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. It was published in 1889, became an instant success, and has never been out of print. Its popularity was such that the number of registered Thames boats went up 50% in the year following its publication, and it contributed significantly to the Thames becoming a tourist attraction. In its first 20 years alone, the book sold over 1 million copies worldwide. It has been adapted to films, TV and radio shows, stage plays, and a musical. Sometimes the title is extended to Three Men in a Boat, to say nothing of the dog. And as Montmorency is a significant character, it seems fitting. The book has been categorized as a comic travelogue, perhaps the first, and the writing style influenced many humorists and satirists in England and elsewhere. As our musical touchstone to accompany this reading, we will use Peter Dawson's rendition of Old Father Thames, recorded in 1933. There will be 17 episodes in this presentation, read to you by Bruce Carlson. Please join me now for episode 14 of Three Men in a Boat.
Oh, how delightful it was to be safe in the boat after our trials and fears. We ate a hearty supper, George and I, and we should have had some tea after it if we could have found the coffee, but we could not. We examined Harris as to what he had done with it, but he did not seem to know what we meant by coffee, or what we were talking about at all. Montmorency looked as if he knew something, but said nothing. I slept well that night, and should have slept better if it had not been for Harris. I have a vague recollection of having been woke up at least a dozen times during the night by Harris wandering about the boat with a lantern, looking for his clothes. He seemed to be worried about his clothes all night. Twice he routed up George and myself to see if we were lying on his trousers. George got quite wild the second time. "What the thunder do you want your trousers for in the middle of the night?" he asked indignantly. "Why don't you lie down and go to sleep?" I found him in trouble the next time I awoke because he could not find his socks, and my last hazy remembrance is of being rolled over on my side and of hearing Harris muttering something about it being an extraordinary thing where his umbrella could have got to. Chapter 15. We woke late the next morning, and as Harris's earnest desire, partook of a plain breakfast with no dainties. Then we cleaned up and put everything straight, a continual labor which was beginning to afford me a pretty clear insight into the question that had often posed me, namely, how a woman with the work of only one house on her hands manages to pass away her time. And at about 10, set out on what we determined should be a good day's journey. We agreed that we would pull this morning as a change from towing, and Harris thought the best arrangement would be that George and I should scull and he steer. I did not chime in with this idea at all. I said I thought Harris would have been showing a more proper spirit if he had suggested that he and George should work and let me rest a bit. It seemed to me that I was doing more than my fair share of work on this trip, and I was beginning to feel strongly on the subject. It always does seem to me that I am doing more work than I should do. It is not that I object to the work, mind you. I like the work. It fascinates me. I can sit and look at it for hours. I love to keep it by me. The idea of getting rid of it nearly breaks my heart. You cannot give me too much work. To accumulate work has almost become a passion with me. My study is so full of it now that there is hardly an inch of room for any more. I shall have to throw out a wing soon. I am careful of my work, too. Why, some of the work that I have by me now has been in my possession for years and years. There isn't a finger mark on it. I take great pride in my work. I take it down now and then and dust it. No man keeps his work in a better state of preservation than I do. But though I crave for work, I still like to be fair. I do not ask for more than my proper share. But I get it without asking for it, at least, so it appears to me, and this worries me. George says he does not think I need trouble myself on the subject. He thinks it is only my over-scrupulous nature that makes me fear I am having more than my due, and that, as a matter of fact, I couldn't have half as much as I ought. But I expect he only says this to comfort me. In a boat, I have always noticed that it is the fixed idea of each member of the crew that he is doing everything. Harris's notion was that it was he alone who had been working, and that both George and I had been imposing upon him. George, on the other hand, ridiculed the idea of Harris's having done anything more than eat and sleep, and had a cast-iron opinion that it was he, George, himself, who had done all the labor worth speaking of. He said he had never been out with such a couple of lazy skulks as Harris and I. That amused Harris. Fancy old George talking about work, he laughed. Why, about half an hour of it would kill him. Have you ever seen George work? He added, turning to me. I agreed with Harris that I never had, most certainly not since we had started this trip. Well, I don't see how you can know much about it one way or the other, George retorted on Harris, for I'm blessed if you haven't been asleep half the time. Have you ever seen Harris fully awake, except at mealtime? Asked George, addressing me. Truth compelled me to support George. Harris had been very little good in the boat so far as helping was concerned from the beginning. Well, hang it all, I've done more than old Jay anyhow, rejoined Harris. Well, you couldn't very well have done less, added George. I suppose Jay thinks he's the passenger, continued Harris. And that was their gratitude to me for having brought them in their wretched old boat all the way up from Kingston, and from having superintended and managed everything for them, and taken care of them and slaved for them. It is the way of the world. We settled the present difficulty by arranging that Harris and George should scull up past Reading, and that I should tow the boat on from there. Pulling a heavy boat against a strong stream has few attractions for me now. There was a time, long ago, when I used to clamor for the hard work. Now I like to give it to the youngsters for a chance. I notice that most of the old river hands are similarly retiring whenever there is any stiff pulling to be done. You can always tell the old river hand by the way in which he stretches himself out upon the cushions at the bottom of the boat, and encourages the rowers by telling them anecdotes about the marvelous feats he has performed last season. "Call what you're doing hard work," he drawls between his contented whiffs, addressing the two perspiring novices who have been grinding away steadily upstream for the last hour and a half. "Why, Jim Biffles and Jack and I, last season, pulled up from Marlow to Goring in one afternoon, never stopped once. You remember that, Jack?" Jack, who has made himself a bed up in the prow of all the rugs and coats he can collect, and who has been lying there asleep for the last 2 hours, partially wakes up on being thus appealed to, and recollects all about the matter, and also remembers that there was an unusually strong stream against them all the way, likewise a stiff wind. "About 34 miles, I suppose, it must have been," adds the first speaker, reaching down another cushion to put behind his head. "No, no, don't exaggerate, Tom," murmurs Jack reprovingly. 33 at the outside. and Jack and Tom, quite exhausted by this conversational effort, drop off to sleep once more, and the two simple-minded youngsters at the Skulls feel quite proud of being allowed to row such wonderful oarsmen as Jack and Tom, and strain away harder than ever. When I was a young man, I used to listen to these tales from my elders and take them in and swallow them and digest every word of them and then come up for more. But the new generation do not seem to have the simple faith of the old times. We, George, Harris, and myself, took a Rawn up with us once last season, and we plied him with the customary stretchers about the wonderful things we had done all the way up. We gave him all the regular ones, the time-honored lines that have done duty up the river with every boating man for years past, and added 7 entirely original ones that we had invented for ourselves, including a really quite likely story founded, to a certain extent, on all but true episodes, which had actually happened in a modified degree some years ago to friends of ours, a story that a mere child could have believed without injuring itself much. And that young man mocked at them all, and wanted us to repeat the feats then and there, and bet us 10 to 1 that we didn't. We got to chatting about our rowing experiences this morning, and to recounting stories of our first efforts in the art of oarsmanship. My own earliest boating recollection is of 5 of us contributing 3 pence each and taking out a curiously constructed craft on the Regent's Park Lake, drying ourselves subsequently in the park keeper's lodge. After that, having acquired a taste for the water, I did a good deal of rafting in various suburban brick fields, an exercise providing more interest and excitement than might be imagined, especially when you are in the middle of the pond and the proprietor of the materials of which the raft is constructed suddenly appears on the bank with a big stick in his hand. Your first sensation on seeing this gentleman is that somehow or other you don't feel equal to company and conversation, and that if you could do so without appearing rude, you would rather avoid meeting him. And your object is, therefore, to get off on the opposite side of the pond to which he is, and to go home quietly and quickly, pretending not to see him. He, on the contrary, is yearning to take you by the hand and talk to you. It appears that he knows your father and is intimately acquainted with yourself, but this does not draw you towards him. He says he'll teach you to take his boards and make a raft of them, but seeing that you know how to do this pretty well already, the offer, though doubtlessly kindly meant, seems a superfluous one on his part, and you are reluctant to put him to any trouble by accepting it. His anxiety to meet you, however, is proof against all your coolness, and the energetic manner in which he dodges up and down the pond so as to be on the spot to greet you when you land is really quite flattering. If he be of a stout and short-winded build, you can easily avoid his advances, but when he is of the youthful and long-legged type, a meeting is inevitable. The interview is, however, extremely brief, most of the conversation being on his part, your remarks being mostly of an exclamatory and monosyllabic order, and as soon as you can tear yourself away, you do so. I devoted some 3 months to rafting, and, being then as proficient as there was any need to be at that branch of the art, I determined to go in for rowing proper, and joined one of the Lee boating clubs. Being out in a boat on the River Lee, especially on Saturday afternoons, soon makes you smart at handling a craft, and spry at escaping being run down by roughs or swamped by barges, and it is also affords plenty of opportunity for acquiring the most prompt and graceful method of lying down flat at the bottom of the boat so as to avoid being chucked out into the river by passing tow lines. But it does not give you style. It was not till I came to the Thames that I got style. My style of rowing is very much admired now. People say it is so quaint. George never went near the water until he was 16. Then he and 8 other gentlemen of about the same age went down in a body to Kew one Saturday with the idea of hiring a boat there and pulling to Richmond and back. One of their number, a shock-headed youth named Joskins, who had once or twice taken out a boat on the Serpentine, told them it was jolly fun boating. The tide was running out pretty rapidly when they reached the landing stage, and there was a stiff breeze blowing across the water. But this did not trouble them at all, and they proceeded to select their boat. There was an 8-oared racing outrigger drawn up on the stage. That was the one they took their fancy. They said they'd have that one, please. The boatman was away, and only his boy was in charge. The boy tried to damp their ardor for the outrigger, and showed them 2 or 3 very comfortable-looking boats of the family party build. But those would not do at all. The outrigger was the boat they thought they would look best in. So the boy launched it. They took off their coats and prepared to take their seats. The boy suggested that George, who even in those days was always the heavy man of any party, should be number 4. George said he should be happy to be number 4, and promptly stepped into bow's place, and sat down with his back to the stern. They got him into his proper position at last, and then the others followed. A particularly nervous boy was appointed cox, and the steering principle was explained to him by Joskins. Joskins himself took stroke. He told the others that it was simple enough. All they had to do was follow him. They said they were ready, and the boy on the landing stage took a boat hook and shoved them off. What then followed, George is unable to describe in detail. He has a confused recollection of having immediately on starting received a violent blow in the small of the back from the butt end of number 5 sculls. At the same time, that his own seat seemed to disappear from under him by magic and leave him sitting on the boards. He also noticed, as a curious circumstance, that number 2 was at the same instant lying on his back at the bottom of the boat, his legs in the air, apparently in a fit. They passed under Kew Bridge, broadside, at the rate of 8 miles an hour, Joskins being the only one who was rowing. George, on recovering his seat, tried to help him, but on dipping his oar into the water, it immediately, to his intense surprise, disappeared under the boat and nearly took him with it. And then Cox threw both rudder lines overboard and burst into tears. How they got back, George never knew, but it took them just 40 minutes. A dense crowd watched the entertainment from Kew Bridge, with much interest, and everybody shouted out to them different directions. 3 times they managed to get the boat back through the arch, and 3 times they were carried under it again. And every time Cox looked up and saw the bridge above him, he broke out in renewed sobs. George said he little thought that afternoon that he should ever come to really like boating. Harris is more accustomed to sea rowing than to river work, and says that, as an exercise, he prefers it. I don't. I remember taking a small boat out at Eastbourne last summer. I used to do a good deal of sea rowing years ago, and I thought I should be all right. But I found I had forgotten the art entirely. When one scull was deep down underneath the water, the other would be flourishing wildly about in the air. To get a grip of the water with both at the same time, I had to stand up. The parade was crowded with nobility and gentry, and I had to pull past them in this ridiculous fashion. I landed halfway down the beach and secured the services of an old boatman to take me back. I like to watch an old boatman rowing, especially one who has been hired by the hour. There is something so beautifully calm and restful about his method. It is so free from that fretful haste, that vehement striving that is every day becoming more and more the bane of 19th century life. He is not forever straining himself to pass all the other boats. If another boat overtakes him and passes him, it does not annoy him. As a matter of fact, they all do overtake him and pass him all those that are going his way. This would trouble and irritate some people, the sublime equanimity of the hired boatmen under the ordeal affords us a beautiful lesson against ambition and uppishness. Plain practical rowing of the get the boat along order is not a very difficult art to acquire, but it takes a good deal of practice before a man feels comfortable when rowing past girls. It is the time that worries a youngster. It's jolly fun, he says, as for the 20th time, within 5 minutes, he disentangles his sculls from yours. I can get on all right when I'm by myself. To see two novices try to keep time with one another is very amusing. Bao finds it impossible to keep pace with Stroke because Stroke rows in such an extraordinary fashion. Stroke is intensely indignant at this, and explains that what he has been endeavoring to do for the last 10 minutes is to adapt his method to Bao's limited capacity. Bao, in turn, then becomes insulted and requests Stroke not to trouble his head about him, Bao, but to devote his mind to setting a sensible stroke. Or shall I take Stroke, he adds, with the evident idea that that would be at once put the whole matter right. They splash along for another 100 yards, with still moderate success, and then the whole secret of their trouble bursts upon Stroke like a flash of inspiration. I tell you what it is. You've got my sculls, he cries, turning to Bao. Pass yours over. Well, do you know, I've been wondering how it was I couldn't get on with these, answers Bao, quite brightening up and most willingly assisting in the exchange. Now we shall be right. But they are not even then. Stroke has to stretch his arms nearly out of their sockets to reach his sculls now, while Bao's pair, at each recovery, hit him a violent blow in the chest. So they change back again and come to the conclusion that the man has given them the wrong set altogether. And over their mutual abuse of this man, they become quite friendly and sympathetic. George said he had often longed to take to punting for a change. Punting is not as easy as it looks, as in rowing, you soon learn how to get along and handle a craft. But it takes a long practice before you can do this with dignity and without getting water all up your sleeve. One young man I knew had a very sad accident happen to him the first time he went punting. He had been getting on so well that he had grown quite cheeky over the business and was walking up and down the punt, working his pole with a careless grace that was quite fascinating to watch. Up he would march to the head of the punt, plant his pole, and then run right along to the other end, just like an old punter. Oh, it was grand. And it would all have gone on being grand if he had not, unfortunately, while looking around to enjoy the scenery, taken just one step more than there was any necessity for, and walked off the punt altogether. The pole was firmly fixed in the mud, and he was left clinging to it, an undignified position for him. I could not go to his assistance because, as ill luck would have it, we had not taken the proper precaution to bring along a spare pole with us. I could only sit and look at him. His expression as the pole slowly sank with him, I shall never forget. There was so much thought in it. I watched him gently let down into the water and saw him scramble out, sad and wet. I could not help laughing. He looked such a ridiculous figure. I continued to chuckle to myself about it for some time, and then it suddenly forced in upon me that I really had got to very little to laugh at when I came to think of it. Here was I, alone in a punt, without a pole, drifting helplessly down midstream, possibly towards a weir. I began to feel very indignant with my friend for having stepped overboard and gone off in that way. He might, at all events, have left me the pole. I drifted on for about a quarter mile, and then I came in sight of a fishing punt, moored in midstream, in which sat two old fishermen. They saw me bearing down upon them, and they called out to me to keep out of their way. "I can't," I shouted back. "But you don't try," they answered. I explained the matter to them when I got nearer, and they caught me and lent me a pole. The weir was just 50 yards below. I am glad they happened to be there. The first time I went punting was in the company of 3 other fellows, and they were going to show me how to do it. We could not all start together, so I said I would go down first and get out the punt, and then I would potter about and practice a bit until they came. I could not get a punt out that afternoon. They were all engaged, so I had nothing else to do but to sit down on the bank, watching the river and waiting for my friends. I had not been sitting there long before my attention became attracted to a man in a punt who, I noticed with some surprise, wore a jacket and cap exactly like mine. He was evidently a novice at punting, and his performance was most interesting. You never knew what was going to happen when he put the pole in. He evidently did not know himself. Sometimes he shot upstream, sometimes he shot downstream, and at other times he simply spun around and came up the other side of the pole. And with every result, he seemed equally surprised and annoyed.
You have been listening to episode 14 of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. Please remember that if you miss an episode, you can find it by going to our website, ktwh.org, and clicking on Programs, and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each week, we will post the episodes from the prior 2 weeks for you to catch up on. Please join me next time for episode 15 of Three Men in a Boat, here on Literally from the North Shore. Down to the mighty sea. What does he know? What does he care? Nothing for you or me. All Father Thames keeps rolling along down to the mighty sea. He never seems to worry, doesn't care for fortunes of fame. He never seems to hurry, but he gets there just the same.